1993 McGivney Lecture Number 4, Biological Happening or a Future for Mankind. And now, Professor Lejeune.
The biological happening I wanted to discuss with you this evening is a very remarkable fact that what we call animation is in fact an alienation of the matter. Suddenly, the matter do not behave like ordinary matter, but is forced to behave as the information tells to the matter what it should do. And then, in the true sense of the term, life is, so to speak, an alienation of the matter. It begins on a very peculiar surrounding. If we look at the history of life, it seems that life has begun inside the waters. At least it's what is taught in the Bible. It's what is taught also in the books about evolution. But curiously, we begin also. I was stopping the progress. We begin also in a very curious medium. Now, in the bottom of the sea, you can recognize easily that this is seaweed. But in fact, it's not seaweed. It is she-weed. That's the lining of the uterus with an electronic microscope at the time that it is ripe to receive the first implantation. And it is remarkable that to the human eye it looks like seaweed, and nobody can make a mistake about the diagnosis. The beginning of life is a very rapid phenomenon, which I have just made a little drawing about it. But after the entry of the sperm inside the zona pellucida, which is a kind of plastic bag, which is in fact the wall of the private life of the early embryo, as soon as the head has has gone through the membrane, here we see it's not human, that's a mice, as you can recognize by the long thing. The head of the sperm is now coming to the zona pellucida, and with that it will drill a hole, and you see that it has drilled a little hole, and now it's going inside, and half of the head is now inside the zona pellucida. What you should remark that there is already a change in the molecular structure of the surface, which has suddenly changed at the moment the hole has been drilled for the first time, and which now is totally changing at the moment the whole head will go inside. As soon as the head is inside, this zona pellucida becomes absolutely non-perforable by another sperm. So that the door is definitely closed, and all the information necessary and sufficient is now inside, and no information will come in during the whole life of the new individual. Then conception is really what happens at the beginning of life. And here we touch a very simple and moving conjunction between science and common language. At the very beginning, when the information carried by the sperm has made the entry inside the egg, and the whole information necessary and sufficient is now inside this little sphere of 1.5 millimeters, we know that everything necessary is spelled out. And it is remarkable that we use the same word to define an idea coming in our mind and a new individual coming to life. We speak about conception. We have a conceptus, a concept of an idea. We conceive an idea, and when a baby is conceived, we call him a conceptus. And that is not a poverty of the vocabulary, but it is in fact an extremely precise definition of what is the beginning of life. It's because there is a moment at which the language of nature has been so miniaturized, as I told you previously, that now we do not make the difference between information and matter, between spirit and body. We use one word, conception, to define the start of both of them, because they are tightly united at this very moment. With the progression of the complexity, the new being has to manifest all the information it contains, and because he is bound to become a very big system compared to one cell, it begins to divide feverishly. But you have to remember that after the sperm has got in, and that the first cell begins to split in two, it is still inside the plastic bag, inside the zona pellucida, and all the beginning of the embryonic development is totally protected from mother activity. It's totally independent. That's the reason why in vitro fertilization is not all possible. Because in nature, the egg is free in the liquid, which is around here, and the sperm are swimming in it for reaching that egg, so that the egg, being protected by its little shell, so to speak, is really independent of the mother for quite a while, for 5 days. Then it divides first in two cells, and what was the surprise of the old embryologist, and it is described in most of the book, but not any longer now, I don't know why, but it's still true, that one of the cells split in two, but the other remain unsplitted. And at the very beginning, there is a stage of three cells, which was a great surprise, because you are supposing you divide by two, then in four, then 8 and 16, but that's not true. It begins by three. The interest is very great, and I will come back to that in a moment. Then this one divides, and this one, which was late, will progressively build the envelopes. And those who were, the one who was early, will build the body. Then we come to four, then each of them divide, we come to 8, we come to 16, and what happens then, it's a compaction, and the cell begin to hook to each other, and the little mass inside the plastic bag becomes now smaller than the plastic bag, so that there is water around, and it has contracted. Let's show you a picture of that, so that you have an impression of what it looks like. because the drawing is easier to define. But here you have to remember that it's not natural, because the plastic bag has been removed. Normally you would not see that. So it's mice, and the plastic bag has been removed, so that you see the cells, and suddenly they compact. Now, the result of that compaction is that the cells which are inside get compressed by those who are outside. Now, let's come back where we were. When you have 16 cells, it's like having in a big sphere 16 marbles. How could you put them inside? It's very easy. You have to put 3 in the middle and 13 around. That is 7 at the equator, and 3 on the top, 3 underneath, and 3 in the middle. Now, the result is that the 3 which are in the middle would get compressed suddenly, decide that they will walk together and they will build the body. Now, the surrounding ones, which will now expand that way, will build the membranes, and later they will build the placenta. Membrane and the placenta are just as important as the initiation of the embryo itself, because it makes a kind of space capsule in which this tiny cosmonaut will begin its own life, which we could not live at all if he was not producing himself its own capsule. So to speak, it's like an astronaut who would be building around himself the shuttle entirely. At the end of another division, one of the cells shifts its metabolism, and it is producing a stuff, maybe that cell, which is digesting the shell, and the whole thing goes out exactly as if it was already an animal. The way it goes out is like an animal going out. It hatches, and the hatching happens at around the 6th day, because the division occurs quite every 24 hours. That's very important, because if the hatching is too early, then the individual would go out inside the tube, because the tube is what carries the egg from the ovary to the uterus. And if it was hooking on the tube, it would be a great danger, because the tube cannot expand enough as the uterus, and the extra uterine pregnancy gives rise to rupture, to bleeding, and they must be operated. I'll come back in a moment to that particular question, because Professor May brought to my attention very interesting publication, and I think it's important we come back to that. But not to complicate too much, let's continue. We have started the divisions, and then we look that at the fourth division, we have 16 cells, 3 in the middle. Now, you have to realize that in experiment, it's possible with an egg which has divided up to 8 cells or to 16 cells to remove some cells and to put other cells coming from another embryo. That's easy with mice. And it has been made. And the result is extremely interesting. You take an embryo of mouse which is bound to be a black mouse. You take another one which is bound to be a white mouse, because you know the progenitors, and it's easy to say that this one is a pure black, this one is a pure white. Now, you take part of the white, and you put it inside the black one after removing the cell, so that the number of cells remains the same. In most of the cases, it dies because it's a rather complicated intervention. But in many cases, it survives, and what comes out is a tiny little mouse, perfectly healthy, but on the fur, you will see a kind of chessboard of parts which are dark, parts which are white, and you see that two lines of cells have combined to build the organism. Experimentalists are never happy with one experiment, so they tried to now take three different strains, one black, one white, and one khaki. And in that case, you get rare mice who have this chessboard with three different colors. Well, we have tried, when I say we, it's not me, but it's the specialist, they have tried to put four different lines, and they never get a baby mice with four different colors. The top number is three. You can put four, five different cell lines, only three are to be found in the mouse, because at the beginning the mouse is telling itself at the three cell stage, we are not a population of cells, we are bound to be a mouse. Now if you manipulate it, they lose that information because you have removed some cells and you have put other cells. But when they compress themselves, they compact themselves, again you have three cells in the middle. And you cannot have more than three lines in the resulting mice. So those experiments have shown definitely that first, the individuality was a kind of trinary system. We need to have three cells talking to each other to decide I am one individual. And you cannot use more than three cells to define one individual. Now, this very peculiar system allow us to understand what are the twins. Twins are just an error of calculation of the number of divisions so that you reach the time at which you should trigger compaction. Look what happens. At the fourth division, we have 16 cells, we get compaction, we have one baby. Now, if this compaction does not occur here, but you have another division, then you will have 32 cells. And inside the sphere of 32 cells, you will have in the middle 3 plus 3 and 26 around. And you will have twins, identical twins. Now, if you have another mistake and you continue to divide, then you would go to triplets. That's very interesting because it tells us that there is a calculating machine in this tiny embryo which is counting the number of divisions. I've divided 1, 2, 3, 4, then I compact. Sometimes the then does not occur immediately, then you divide another time and you get twins. So there is an extraordinary property that even arithmetic is already acting during the first cell cleavage. There is a counter somewhere. We don't know how it is, and probably it's very simple. It must be exchanged between cells and chemical message. And that would be related with the necessity of having an odd number. Because there's an odd number, the exchange cannot be equal. So you have a system to count the number of exchanges that you have got. What is now the reason of this presentation? is that we know now that twins are carrying the same nature. And in fact, a set of identical twins, it's two persons sharing the same nature. That for us is not very complicated to understand. But the most curious is that some people can really feel it. I remember it was in the Academy of Moral and Sociological Science in Paris, political science in Paris, I was giving a talk about the early embryo. And one of my colleagues came after the talk and he told me, well, I did not want to say that in public. But you know, he was a known professor of law. He was nearly 85 or 90 at that time. I don't remember exactly. And he told me, I was a twin. My brother died a few times ago in an accident. And we had had exactly the same career. He was a professor of law like I am. And he told me, you have said that twins were one nature splitted in two persons. Now, I must tell you, doctor, that for my brother and I, the question of the Trinity was never to be discussed because we felt it was possible. I was very much impressed by this kind of confession. He was a very learned man, and really, you have to be identical twins to understand that the idea of one nature splitted in two persons can be felt. Most of us have been made one by one. Nature is very kind with us, and she takes the trouble of not doing a series of us. We cannot feel those things, but twins do. But we know the contrary. And the little mice I was talking about with the chessboard is the contrary. Because in that case, we have united two nature in one individual. And that is known also in man. It happens sometimes that at moment of the fecundation, when there are probably an error in the splitting of the egg, so that the egg is splitted in two cells. And one sperm comes in it, one sperm comes inside the other, and then the individual which will come out is a compound of two different genetic makeup. This has to occur at the very beginning, at the conception. Because if it occurs later, it would be prevented by the closing of the zona pellucida. But if it has occurred just at moment of conception, you can have hermaphrodite, that it's individuals having the sexual appanage of Hermes as male and of Aphrodite as female, and they are abnormal indeed, but if you look at their cells, you will find that they have together XX as a woman, XY as a male, compounded in one individual. And those chimeric hermaphrodites are really two nature united in one person. That, taken together, tell us that the beginning of the individual, that the beginning of our personal life has to arise at the moment of conception and at the latest time at the splitting in three cells. Then, when people are discussing, when does occur the individual, when does occur the unity and the unicity, we can answer, we know it occurs at conception, and if there are some mistakes, maybe few hours after conception, but no later than that. Well, let's suppose that we agree, because science tells us, that what is a human being? A human being is a member of our species. And then, if we have science, what is a person? It is a human being alive. And science has no other answer. Then, if we agree that the personality, as far as biology is concerned, is there at conception, can we make a cross-examination? That is, have we the possibility to say, well, you have seen that, but are you sure that there are no situations in which the contrary could occur? Well, we have this possibility because it has been made possible in mice to change the rules. That is, to build a mice in which no male cell is used, but all the chromosomes are derived from female cells. And that is not an individual, it's not a vein, it's a tumor. It does not give a little mice, it gives a teratoma of the ovary. And what is interesting is that it exists in our species. Sometimes what we call a dermoid cyst occurs in virgins, and we see a tumor growing on the ovary of a little girl, and inside that tumor you would find a horrible mixture of different tissue. There is, you can find teeth, you can find bones, you can find hairs, nails, skin, nerves, but all of that in a full disorder. There is no building whatsoever of a body. So it's only a bag of spare parts. You can do the contrary, and the contrary is to build a mice in which you have removed the pronucleus coming from the mother, so that you have only the chromosome marked at the way the father is marking the chromosome. And in that case, it's not a being, Acer. It's also a tumor. But in that case, the tumor is very different. The tumor is made of vesicles, and it looks like the placenta or the amnios, which are around the baby, so that it makes what is called a molar degeneration. This exists in our species, and it had been demonstrated around 10 years ago or 15 years ago that in molar degeneration there were no chromosomes from mother. All the chromosomes were coming from father. It was a great surprise, and nobody understood really what was meant by nature, that we could find a kind of pregnancy in which there were no baby, but there were tissue looking like vesicles and only carrying male chromosome. Now we have the answer, especially after the discoveries made by Surani. Surani discovered, to the great surprise of the geneticists, nobody had prophesied that not only we receive half of our chromosome from mother and half from father, but that all the women are marking their DNA by a system we call methylation at certain places, and all the women put the methylation at the same place of the DNA. But all the males are marking different places. And all the males are marking the same places, but it's different from the one marked by the mother. So what happens is a very curious result, that on the first egg, which receives of the first fertile egg, which has received the mother chromosome and the father's chromosome, now it has not only all the information written in the DNA, but all the underlined paragraphs that he should read first, then he would read the rest later. In a sense, the beginning of life remembers very much a student trying to prepare the exam. You know, he has the book, and then he underlines what he has to know tomorrow, and he cross what he has maybe to learn later. We do the same. And at the beginning of life, we have underlined exactly what we must read immediately, mother-wise, and what we must read immediately, father-wise. Now, the surprise came when we realized what father was telling us to do and what mother was telling us to do. Mother is telling how to build the spare pieces, hence the possibility of the tumor I was speaking before. Father is telling us how to get the food and to be protected. So how to build the placenta, how to build the membrane. So that we find written inside the chromosome of the first cell, 1 millimeter and a half, we have epitomized the difference of task between the two sexes. That man has to build a hut and go hunting, and mother has to carry about the baby. And it was a great consolation to the geneticist to see that even at the level of the first cell, those things were precisely inscribed. That has very important consequence. That is that the first cell knows all. The first cell knows how to build a human being. Now, when it divides, progressively it changes those methylations, so that in the cells of a grown-up, the little paragraphs which are underlined are still, some of them, underlined in the mother way and in the father way, but most of them have been changed during the growing of the individual, so that the cells are differentiated in a very curious way, that we are able to make from one first cell liver, bones, and brain, and build the individual. And that cannot be reversed. It stays like that until you erase some of the methylation and you methylate some specific place in the ovary to build a right of ovum, and you do the same at a different place inside the testicle. That implies that it's not possible to reproduce without two different sexes, because you need two different sexes to have more information in the first cell. That's a simple addition. It's not only complementary, it does not tell exactly the same thing as far as the time of using those things is written in. It has for us many consequences. The first is that it allows us to understand how from a cell apparently undifferentiated you get the whole individual. It's rather simple. You erase some methylation, you change some of them, and progressively you forget. That is, the cell which is still able in my body to make a nail has forgotten all the rest, but she remembers how to make a nail. So we pretend that this cell has specialized, but she has just lost part of its information. And in that case, really, the development of an individual looks very much like the teaching of students in medicine. Because when they have got their thesis, they are supposed to know everything. And if they become generalists, they will know a lot of things about many things. And the more they grow in their generalist way, the less they know about more things. At the very end, they know very little about a lot of things. Well, but the specialist does the contrary. He learns more and more on less and less. At the very end, he knows everything on nothing. It's exactly what the cells are doing. The first cell knows everything, and progressively, by forgetting, the cells do specialize and express what was written in the first cell. Then, the conclusion is, and that may be a scoop for some of you, a consolating scoop, that the gay nightmare will not be realized. It's not possible to take two different sperm, to put them inside an egg, to remove the female pronucleus, to have a progeny of two males. That will be a tumor, but not a human being. On the same way, the pretension of the lesbians to have, by genetic manipulation, a child between two females with no intervention of a male cell is totally out of order. It will never occur. It's not that it is forbidden by the law, it's forbidden by nature. And even the cloning, that is the production of a new individual from a nucleus of any part of its body, is not possible, because it will not have inside it this methylation at the appropriate place. And then the speculation of the billionaire to transmit at the same time its financial interest and its genetic capital will not be realized. This speculation is totally devaluated by new genetics. What is interesting is that was not foreseen 10 years ago, and it's only the discovery on the last 5 years which have allowed us to be sure that those things are really like that. But remains a curious question. Can it be possible that a man can be so much reduced to be this tiny sphere of 1 millimeter and a half? Does it is possible that it is the most simple formula? You know, the algebraists like to reduce the formula to its simplest form. And is that possible, that the formula of man can be reduced that way? Well, the fact is, not only that it's possible, but it is right. And the reason why we know it, it's because we can stop the process of manifestation of life. That can be made by lowering the temperature. In Latin and in French, and also a little in English, we use the same word to define the heat that we measure with a thermometer and the duration that we measure with a pendulum or with a clock. In French we say temps and température. In English, you can say tempo and temperature. In Latin, it's the same word. And that, again, is not a poverty of the vocabulary, but it is a definition of something which was very difficult to understand before we knew the particulate nature and the Brownian movement, that what we call heat, what we call temperature, is just the speed of the molecule measured with the thermometer with the number of heat. And what we call time is in fact the flux of this energy through this movement. So if we slow down the movement, what, by lowering the temperature, what we do is to slow down the time inside this cell. And that explains why we can use cryopreservation, we can make congelation of living cells, and once they are in liquid nitrogen, they don't move, they have no metabolism, and apparently they are entirely dead. But no one of us would pretend that they are dead, because we know that if we give them back the temperature, the normal temperature, then they will manifest their life again. Then we are obliged to know that when we make congelation, what we are congelating is not the cell, it's not the life, we are congelating the time. We are freezing the time. And when the cell is kept in this frozen time, then there is no change occurring. There is no aging if the frost is very deep. It has to be as deep as possible. Liquid nitrogen is not deep enough, but we use liquid nitrogen in biology because it does not cost too much and it does not explode. Liquid hydrogen is much lower in temperature and would produce a much better preservation for a long time. But nevertheless, liquid nitrogen is rather cool, and it allows to keep the cell not moving, not breathing, not doing anything for years. And the embryos are just as resistant as ordinary cells, so that embryos can be frozen. But curiously, an egg before fecundation cannot be frozen. It can be frozen in the sense of being refrigerated, but it will not survive when it comes back to normal temperature. And we do not know really why the fact that the entry of the sperm has so much changed the physical structure of the egg that now it resists the congelation and it can be chilled. Although, if it was before fecundation that you had congelated the egg, it would not survive. That proves, again, that the change at the moment of conception is physically irreversible and makes a total difference between an egg and a new individual. That was the introduction of what I wanted to discuss now. I have been long, but science is very patient to try to see around, to gather the information. Because what I would like to discuss now is what can we do to convince people that life and human life is so precious that it should be preserved with the utmost care. And I would just propose to you a broad review of what we can use as arguments. And to try to make some order, I will follow the spirit that is, use the seven gifts of the Spirit to do that. The first gift is wisdom. And I would propose that the best wisdom would be the popular wisdom, the one which for generations has made sexual education of all the babies of the world, not only the grannies in the English-speaking countries, but the great mother everywhere on the globe. There is one story which has been told to every children in the world. It's a story of very tiny human beings living inside a sheltered underground world in which wonders are happening to them. The story of Tom Thumb, of the little man smaller than the thumb, has been spelled in every language since the beginning of humanity for a very simple reason, that the grannies had the wisdom to tell to the next generation that they had been a tiny Tom Thumb in the womb of their mother. And it's still true today, and still you can tell to the children this story and they will understand it, and even grown up, if you tell it with detail, would be interested about it, because it remembers them of something of which the memory is very poor, but which has been so deeply imprinted. At the time they were not thinking at all, but they were feeling, that they still have what I would call an unconscious memory. Well, probably you do not believe me, but I would show you one wonder which is not yet achieved, but which already exists, and which is related to the curious ectopic pregnancy I was talking previously. You remember that the little cosmonaut is building his capsule, his space capsule, and he has a capsule with three envelopes. One is the amnios, and is inside it. I think you can just notice the feet, the hand, and the head here. Now, around it is the chorionic system, and around it, all those hairs that you see are, in fact, the villosity of the chorion. They have been made by the baby. Now, this baby has been removed, and it has been opened so that you see together inside and outside. But that time, if you were looking at a healthy baby, you would see that this big one all around, and you would not see the baby at all inside. Now, when you look closer, you would see that, in fact, those velocities are not loose, but they are hooked to each other by a membrane which makes it another cavity. And this cavity is the intervelocity cavity, has an enormous significance, because here are the vessels of the mother, and the placenta is not yet made, so that what exudates, a kind of edema coming out of the vessel of the mother, goes inside here. Those vessels are the vessels of the baby, so that the baby is getting its fluids and its oxygen by an exchange system of fluid with not any connection with the blood of the mother. It needs only some exudate surrounding the whole thing. Now, it seems very likely that if an ectopic pregnancy was removed with great care and put back inside the uterus with enough of tubal fluid, it would survive and it would implant in the uterus. There are all the reasons to believe that it is possible. There are two publications that Professor May brought to my attention, but unfortunately they are old and they are not very precise. But probably in our time of graft, the idea of grafting the early baby, that is a term thumb, before 2 months, before 3 months of age, is still a possibility. After 3 months, when he has built the placenta, that the blood of the mother circulates inside the placenta, the removal and the implantation would have a time of maybe many hours in which the baby will be without nourishment and it would die anyway. But earlier, as the second month, probably this transplantation will be feasible. And without being a totally prophet, I would guess that one day you will read in the newspaper as a headline, the transplantation of the tubal pregnancy has been a success and is now achieved, and now when the pregnancy is out of the uterus, we can transfer it. By all likelihood, nature is ready for us to help her to do that. But I was coming back to the possibility of convincing the people, and we have to help their understanding, because understanding is the second gift of the spirit. And how make them understood that they really have been a Thompson? You can propose to them a very simple experiment. They have to go inside a discotheque. A discotheque is a very curious place. Generally, you go in by a narrow entrance, and you come in a vaulted shelter with a very dim red light. The temperature is hot. The atmosphere is very damp, and the smell is strong. And there are bodies slowly moving, darting very rapidly. And there is a terrible noise, an enormous noise by the sono, which is made by the contrabass, and which makes your chest moving at its beat of the counterpart. And there is another rhythm, much more rapid, that of the maracas, which makes your head vibrating. And apparently, people do like it. Why? It's just because they remember. There was a time in which they were in a vaulted shelter, in which it was damp, hot, and smelly, and in which they were dancing, and in which there was a terrible noise. There was the heart of mother, which was hammering the stricture at 60 per minute, which is the rate of the counterbass. And there was their own heart running at 150, which is the rate of the maracas. And it's not by chance that the symphony of those two rates has to be found in any popular music. It's always 60 and 140, 150. Why? It's because it's the earliest music that any human ear has heard, that every human ear has heard. Indeed, it is a very primitive symphony, and you are entirely entitled as a grown-up to prefer Mozart. But nevertheless, there was a time at which you have enjoyed it, this symphony between two hearts, which is the one in which you have grown at your very beginning. Well, if understanding is not sufficient, we could use counsel to tell them how to be prudent, how not to run all the future of the humanity in jeopardy. You are not going to tell them that there was a time at which human beings were killing other human beings because they had not the right genes or the right population constitution, you are not going to tell them that there is a mistake in the every dictionary, because euthanasia should not be written like that. Euthanasia has to be written euthanasi, N-R-Z-E, is the way it has been written in blood letter and history. Now, you have not to discuss those things. Just tell them an old story, which is not so emotive. What is the story of Sparta? In Sparta, they had a very severe control of the newborn, and if they were considering that the newborn was too weak to become a soldier, or if she was too weak to carry future soldier, then they were putting the baby in the upper state of the Mount Taygetus so that it could be eaten by the wild beast. But curiously, the Spartans are the only Greek among those people who were the most gifted of the world, of the whole history. They are the only ones which have not given anything to humanity, not a statue, not a poetry, even not a ruin. In the plain of Lacedaemon, nothing is left. Now, for the geneticist, it's an extraordinary question. Is it possible that because they were killing their children when they felt they were too gracile, too fragile, maybe they were killing their future artists, their future poets, their future legislators? What's the possibility? Well, does it is possible that it's because they were already very dull that they were killing their own children? And I guess the real answer is that both facts were probably causative in the fact that nothing is left from Sparta. Now, you have to resist, and to tell the people to resist, to an extraordinarily convincing reasoning. And that there, they need fortitude. What is the next gift of the spirit? And the fortitude is to resist to a ternary, deleterious reasoning, which is diversion, inversion, perversion. The diversion is very simple. They will tell you, don't look at the one who would disappear, but look at what it costs, what the parents would suffer, what the family would suffer, what the society would pay for it. So don't look at the victim, but look at the other. Then will come immediately the inversion, and they will tell you, but look, with all the money, all the dedication we would have spent for that one, look at what the good we will do. We will build new highways, we will reduce the difficulty in the hospital, and we will even sometimes give something to somebody somewhere very far away on the world. Then comes the perversion. The conclusion is, we should discard the innocent. That they will repeat it, not only for abortion, but for euthanasia, for any rejection of those not fitting the rules which are politically correct nowadays. And this reasoning, we know where it comes from. It has been used once. There was a time at which there was a very precious perfume which was used on the feet of the innocent. And there was a man who said, we should have sold that perfume and look at all the good I would have done for the poor. And it is this one who was going to sell his master for 30 pieces of money. Remember, every time you will hear this reasoning, of diversion, inversion, perversion, and they have no other discourse possible. They are just telling you what Judas did. Remains the gift of science. Science cannot tell you all the morality, but it can help you. I remember when, thanks to my friend Martin Palmer, I went to a little town of Marieville in the case of 7 frozen embryos. The judge was listening to science. The story was extraordinary, and sometimes truth invents analogies that writers would not dare to try. The woman was called Mary. The town was called Marieville. The lawyer of the mother was Christian Berry. The judge who had to tell the truth about the earliest human being possible was named Jung. And myself, I carry the same name, but in French. It was an extraordinary moment when I was asked if I had something more to tell to the judge than what I have summarized on those photos here. And if I had some counsel to give. And I said, no. But I have one hope that at that time, Mr. Justice will be on the same side as Solomon. Because what he had to judge was who was the parent to whom the children should be given to custody. And there was a father who was saying that he wanted them frozen forever. And there was a mother proposing her own body to give them the shelter so that they could reach the fresh air later. And this had been judged 3,000 years before, when the king had said to the soldier, cut this child in 2 parts and give half of it to those 2 women. And then one woman said, I'd better give him to the other, but don't kill him. And then the king had said, this one is the true mother. That was the reasoning of the judge Jung, and he used parents' patriae law, telling that the state becomes the parent so that he has to give to the child the best custody he can, and obviously the best custody was the custody of the parent who wanted that the child could live, and not the custody by the parent who wanted the children frozen forever. Unfortunately, science has not been recognized by the Supreme Court of Tennessee, who decided that the baby should be destroyed if the father did not want it. And the supreme injustice was made by the Supreme Court of the United States when it refused to hear the supplication of the mother a few months ago asking, but give me them. It's in a very important step that has not been noticed by the newsman. But it was the first time in this country that innocent, of which the innocence has been established by the justice, were sentenced to death by the Supreme Court of this country. That the first time that innocent have been executed according to an order of the Supreme Court. I don't know if you remember what said. One of the Ali's advocates at Nuremberg, when he said that all that had begun when you killed the first innocent. Unfortunately, you have to know that it has occurred for the first time very recently in this country, after a complete justice decision. Remains two gifts of the Spirit. One is the piety, and the other is the fear of the Lord. Piety is the respect of the law for the respect of the Creator. And probably it is our duty on the day to come to use this piety towards our own nation. We have to tell to our own nation, I don't speak especially about the United States, I speak of any nation, we have to tell to our nation that the law of life are superior to the law that man can edict. And obviously you will be told, and you will be repeated, that in a real democracy, you Catholics, you are not allowed to impose your morals upon others. That's exceedingly interesting, because those who tell you that are not democratic. What is democracy? It is the power of the people. That's what it means. Now, what is the duty of the people? Is to try to enshrine in the law of their country what they suppose, what they consider is the best for their country. So that the very essence of democracy is by your vote to impose your moral upon others. Those who do not accept that definition of democracy are doing totalitarian, are terrorists, are politically correctness, but they are not doing democracy. And I think that it is our duty to realize this. Fear of the Lord is probably the most important. It is lost politically, but it is not lost on the heart of the people. There was a phrase in Latin that we were learning when I was young. It was telling Timete Dominum et Nihil Aliud. Have fear of the Lord and of nothing else. And that's the true liberty. And this liberty will allow us for the future of mankind to choose. And we have to choose, and very soon, between two possibilities. And the choice is between Faust and Jesus. There is no other choice left. Have you thought about why it was so exceedingly interesting to speak about baby in vitro, the bottle babies? Why this fecundation, this artificial fertilization was so interesting for the newspaper? Why they are still publishing about that? There is one man who has told us the whole story 150 years ago, when Goethe wrote the first Faust. You know the story. Marguerite gets pregnant, she kills the baby, and she gets condemned and sentenced to death. And the damnation of Dr. Faust is really the abortion of love. But the second Faust, the one that probably you have not read, it's more possibly modern that you could believe. After the death of Margaret, Faust came back in the whole house he had, and he found his previous student, Fafner, who is working in his old laboratory, and Wagner is manufacturing an homunculus in a bottle, an in vitro baby, 105 years ago. And the poet sees the future, the tiny little creature goes out of the alchemic field and it flees around the head of Faust, and Faust is following this dream baby and he's following it in the past, and he found the ghost of Helen of Troy. He gets in love with her, he has a fancy baby he called Euphorion, which means the pleasure, and which falls down from the sky like Icarus. And finally, when Faust has built an extraordinary empire through the magic of Mephistopheles, he gives the two last orders to the devil. He tells him, you have to silence this tiny bell which is still ringing, because there is one church left in this enormous empire. And he said, you have to move this little cabin in which are still living Philemon and Baucis, who are the paragon of the human law, so that we could increase the channel through which the wealth is flowing. And when Mephisto come back, that he has burned the little church, that he has burned the little cabin with the lover inside, when he has destroyed the two last marks of the divine law and of human law, that's the moment at which the sorrow comes inside the soul of the doctor. And that's the end of the tragedy. Poets do not make science, but they see it coming from very far. And what Faust has described to us is the summum of the pride. Manufacturing a human being in a vessel so that we can say, this has been made at my own similarity. So he has not been made as the image of God. That is the supreme temptation of pride. Then what are we going to do? Because we are becoming every day more and more powerful, every day we will be tempted to use this Faustian power. For example, if a baby is affected by a mistake of the chromosome, by a bad gene, why not discard him if we have made the diagnosis early? Why not to get rid of those patients who cost to the parents, to the society? The reason not to kill them is very simple. Because they will cost a great price in dedication, in suffering to the parents, in suffering maybe to themselves. But this price, we know exactly its amount, is the price which has to be paid to remain humane. And if we refuse to pay it, we will lose what makes us really human. If you don't believe it, I'll tell you a true story, which had been told to me by a great friend who was coming to this country just before the last war. It was here in America, and we had a meeting about in vitro, about testing about prenatal diagnosis and killing the baby. It was 20 years ago. And after the meeting, he told me, I have to tell you a story. He was a professor of embryology, an old man at that time, and he told me, my father was doctor in a little town in Austria, and he told me that one night in this little town two babies were born on the same night on two different families. In one family it was a little boy with a strong voice and everything okay. In the other family there was a little girl with a very low cry. She was a Down syndrome girl. And he said, my father told me that they had a very different destiny, those two children. The girl, when her mother had a stroke, she was 30. And for 4 years, this Down syndrome girl was helping her mother and giving her the food, and those last 4 years of that mother were as good as possible thanks to the dedication of her feeble-minded daughter. And he said, I don't remember the name of the girl, but the name of the boy has never forget it. His name was Adolf Hitler. This story is not invented. It is really true. And it summarizes that we cannot judge among human lives, and we cannot condemn innocent. I would go faster, I would reverse the story. Let's suppose by an impossible prediction that it was known that this baby would be Adolf Hitler. No doctor would have been allowed to kill that baby. But maybe we could have educated him. Then we have to choose. Because we have to rely on some touchstone in which we can be faithful to know that we could do and that we should not do. And we have something who would tell us what is good and what is evil. And there is one phrase that everybody of us know, which could, and it is the only one which could do that, tell us without any technicalities, in every case, what to do. If the politicians remember it, they can make honest law. If the technicians do not forget it, technology will remain the honest servant of humanity. But if both of them don't remember it, then you would have to deal with the denaturated biology, and there would be a very dim future for mankind. This phrase, you know it, it judges everything and forever. It just says, what you have done to the smallest of mine, you have done it unto me.